Welcome to the Aquariumax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
Okay, this is episode 115, recorded May 26, 2012.
Okay, welcome, Mick.
Hi, over there.
We have Mick with us today, and he's going to talk to us about mouth-brooding betas.
This is a long-awaited interview. We finally managed to get it to all work, so we're excited.
Yes, we've overcome all the technical boundaries. So far, so good.
Exactly. So, once again, thanks for joining us, Mick.
Thanks for asking. I've really looked forward to doing this. And like you say, we've kind of crossed time zones and continents and technical boundaries and other things. So let's hope it'll all work.
Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okay, Mick, to get us started, why don't you tell us about yourself as an aquarist? How did you get started in the hobby, and what do you specialize in, that kind of thing?
Okay, well, I've always had an interest in animals, but fish particularly. Even when I was a tiny kid, I know you've just bought one of your young children a little better fish. I think my first ever fish was the stereotypical goldfish in a bowl. It's not something I do now, but that was the kind of thing that people did a lot back in the kind of late 70s, I suppose it would be. So I always had these goldfish in bowls, which would never live very long. And were all called waggletail for want of a better name, really. So I kind of killed off a series of goldfish for a few years as a child. But I always had an interest in fish, and I think it kind of got more serious when I was about 17. That's about 20 years ago, nearly now. And I bought a second-hand, what you would class as a standard 3-foot aquarium off a friend of my father's. And that was just set up with a cartridge powerhead filter and a submersible heater and, you know, an array of plastic plants. And then just a collection of fish that I liked at the time and did variously with. And by accident, I actually bred a few swordtails, a few pineapple swordtails, which was incredibly good fun. And I remember one time the thermostat on the heater overheated, the tank got really, really hot, and the only thing that survived were three or four of these little tiny swordtails, which then grew on into the fully adult and quite happy for a few years. But it was one of those accidental things which kind of got me really seriously into fish. So I kind of did community tanks off and on for a little while and moved around a little bit, so maybe didn't have a tank for a couple of years. But then probably about 5 years ago, got back into it, got myself a nice biggish fish tank again, and started with a few community fish, and then started listening to Pet Fish Talk, which I found by accident on iTunes. And I remember one of the things that one of the guys there used to say, one of his regular things was join a fish club. So I looked up and by chance found a flyer for a local fish club in the aquarium shop, and just kind of followed the contact email on there, joined the fish club, and it's kind of blown out of all proportion since then, really. So I've kept quite a range of fish. I've not specialised in any one thing, but I've kind of had periods where I've done more live bearers or more cichlids or, you know, an array of different things. I kind of find a fish that I like, have some success with, and then try other varieties. And a few years ago, a friend of mine gave me a pair of mouth-brooding bettas, and that was another great, exciting project.
And you've also done quite a bit with inverts, both terrestrial and aquatic, isn't that true?
Yeah, that's right. I suppose these days I'm doing more of the river shrimp. I've just ordered some nice bee shrimp that should hopefully come next week. I've been trying to get some nice bee shrimp for a couple of months now, but hopefully these will come and be quite good. But I've been breeding assassin snails following your kind of successes, which I've heard about on the podcast, and got some nice apple snails. I've got some ivory whites at the moment, some blues, like a powder blue, and I've had some purple striped as well. So some of those are pretty big now. I mean, some of the striped ones are certainly just a bit bigger than a good golf ball, so we're doing quite well.
Yeah. Hey. That's a lot of fun stuff that we have going. We're going to have to interview you again about some of the other things sometime.
Yeah, maybe.
Today we're talking about mouth-brooding bettas. I think a lot of our listeners, they think of bettas. They think of Bettas Flendens.
Yeah.
That's what they see in the shops and so on. So could you kind of paint us a picture of how mouth-brooding bettas are different visually, behaviorally, environmentally, and maintenance-wise, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, we've had a kind of a succession of the what are called over here the clusters, basically either fighting fish or Siamese fighters, and people will class the fighters and the bettas. They almost seem as two different fish, generally in the UK. Of course, they're all derived from the kind of same wild types, and the mouth brooding types are much more along the lines of the wild types or the wild species types. I've had three or four different strains, from some which are, you know, quite small, smaller fins but nice colours, up to one I had which was called Betta Raja. Really interesting fish. I'd never got to breed it. It was just very, very skittish. But these were fish that grew to probably a good, you know, four and a half inches, kind of a brown, quite a cryptic colouring. So once they got in amongst the kind of leaf litter and the bogwood and stuff in the tank I had them in, they were really difficult to see. But the one that I had the main success with, to start with at least, was one called Betta Simplex. Again, unlike the kind of the fighters or the Splendens, much shorter fins and less intense, you know, all over body colour, but very, very interesting striking colours, patterns, markings. For me, personally, if I had to buy one or the other, I would go for the kind of the mouth brooding bettas, the more wild types every time. And unlike the Splendens type, you can actually have a community of mouth brooding bettas all in one tank, so you don't have the situation of breeding things and, you know, having 100 jars stacked up on shelves everywhere. You can kind of, to a degree, get away with it all in one tank.
That's nice.
The aggression just seems to be a lot lower between the...
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, the males are actually quite submissive. It's the females that lead the way with these things. And when I kind of got onto a definite breeding, I actually set up three tanks. And if you were going to keep them as a group to start with, I mean, I've got a group of Betta Rubra downstairs in the toad paludarium, some juveniles a friend gave me, and they're just all in there together to grow on for a while. But for when I got on to a more concentrated breeding situation, I had one female and two males. If you just have a pair, like you would have with a lot of fish, a traditional pair, the male will get very quickly just depleted and worn out, because the females can be quite persistent.
Have a switch.
So like I said, they tend to be, you know, much more peaceful. I mean, some people have the Betta Imbellis, which it looks similar, but it is a bubble nester, like the Splendens type. And again, sometimes over here they're known as the peaceful Betta, and you can keep them in a community. But they are, unlike these fish, they are a bubble nester, whereas the mouth brooders obviously have a completely different approach to breeding and rearing the young.
Right. And I've heard that there are some species out there that can switch depending on the environment, that they'll build a bubble nest when the conditions suit that, but when the water is a little bit too active or it flows too much, that they'll actually mouth brood instead.
Oh, right. I've not come across that one in any of the ones I've kept, but it'd be an interesting one to see which do.
Yeah, I don't remember any of the species. I'll have to look that up, but it was interesting to see that. And I think an interesting thing, too, from what I understand, there are actually more mouth-brooding bettas out there than there are bubble-nesting bettas.
Yeah, I mean, the list that I've looked at for... one of the main resources I use is the International Betta Congress, and a lot of their species are mouth-brooding species, and they have a heck of a range on their website.
Yeah.
Do we have a link to that on our page yet?
We'll make sure we put one on the show page, that'll be great. So as far as the environment that the mouth brooding bettas require, how is that different from what Betta Splendens need?
Well, I mean, for mine, I've all, like I said, I've kind of done it two different ways. I've kind of done it in a small community setup, and I've done it much more specialised. And the first kind of setup I had was it was 2 foot long tank. And one of the things with I think it does happen to a degree with the better Splendens, but a lot of the betters, and these particular, are fantastic jumpers. You will find a number that end up crispy fried fish on the floor or the shelf or somewhere. So I always drop the water level down to about half, only fill the tank to halfway, and always add a really good tight fitting lid. Any gaps or any holes where wires or pipes or anything come through, I always plug it up with filter floss or tape or something like that. Because if there's a gap, if there's a chink, they will try and go for it, and they can jump. I mean, they can seriously, they can jump far further than I can, and I'm a heck of a lot bigger than they are. So they can leap out of the water, and they always do it when you're not looking. So, but they have one or two species tend to be a little bit more suicidal than the others for some reason. But yeah, I would say whatever you do, drop the water level down in your setup and have a fantastically good lid on the top. So yeah, the community setup was like a 2 foot tank, water level halfway, couple of maybe 3 inch diameter terracotta pots, a few a little bit of floating plants, not too much. And I planted up reasonably well. I don't use a lot of substrate in my fish room, and that's just it's really just a practicality thing. I can get a little siphon hose and siphon all the junk off the floor, and keep things clean without stirring up gravel and having to plunge things like gravel vacuums down through gravel and things like that. I'm not really growing, you know, that kind of plant in there. When I'm doing a lot of the breeding stuff, they've got to be pretty practical, functional tanks. So there's no substrate, but I did put the shelf that they were on. I had black plastic over the top of the shelf before the tank went on, so there wasn't reflection coming up from the bottom, which would confuse them. So yeah, that was it. It was a fairly simple setup. My water here out the tap's pretty soft. But I collect and condition rainwater, so that's kind of, I try and keep that on a par with the tap water, so if I do ever need to chop and change, I don't get, you know, big fluctuations in the what kind of water parameters. And just a little bit of leaf litter in there. I'm lucky that I work outside, so I can always collect oak leaves and beech leaves. There's loads of trees like that around here in the autumn, so I kind of bag them up, dry them out on a big tray in the fish room, and then put them into plastic bags, and they can store for a couple of years like that. So I'll just blanch them in hot water in a jug and then dump them in the tanks. So I got a trio of simplex, and they went into this 2 foot setup, one male, two females, and I just left them to their own devices for a while, didn't do anything special. And one day I was sat in the fish room, and lo and behold, they started displaying to each other.
And were the males or the females the ones that were displaying more, or was it more equal?
Well, the female tended to pick one particular male, and both the males were about the same size. One of the males developed a slightly stronger coloration when the female started to attract him. And in my experience, it's always been the females that kind of chase one male round and round the tank until he kind of throws the towel in and agrees to go in with the courtship. And he will kind of dip his head down, his coloration and his patterning will change, his fins will go out. And they can spend quite some time kind of doing this little dance. He'll kind of drop down, display his fins, shimmy around a bit. She'll kind of circle around him, and then she'll chase him around a bit more. And then and eventually the kind of this standoff gets less and less. And just quite by chance, and they both started to clasp each other. And a bit like the Splendens do, they kind of have this quite close embrace and start to drop down the water column. Mine only ever went a few inches up off the floor to do this, my mouth breeding types. So they will come just a few inches off the floor, wrap around each other in the embrace, and then start to sink to the floor. And they would do this maybe for a second or two, then a few more seconds, and each embrace would start to last that little bit longer and be that little bit tighter. And the first time, actually, when I'd sat kind of watching them on and off for a good couple of hours, and then the lights went off, so it was about 10 o'clock at night. And when I went in the next evening, this was still going on, so they were still going through this courtship and kind of embracing, squeezing, spawning situation for a good, I would say, at least 36 hours.
Wow.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating to watch.
Like, they'd be in kind of a risky situation as far as predators and things go. How does that work in the wild?
I don't know.
What are their predators in the wild?
Bigger
fish?
I imagine it would be bigger fish. It would be birds. It would be just the normal sort of things you'd find. But, it's surprising that their courtship is that long.
Yeah. I've since seen it over and done with quicker. I think this was possibly because it was one of their first times and it just took them a lot longer to get into the kind of swing of things.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, but from then, it still seemed to go on, even then when they'd spawned again, you know, the second male was pushed right to the far end of the tank at this time, and these two that had paired kind of hogged two-thirds of the tank, and if he kind of poked his head out, he would be chased away. Even from then on, you know, this kind of the courtship and the kind of embrace ritual would definitely go on for several hours each time.
Wow.
And so did you actually see them during the courtship? Did you see the point when they began to release the eggs?
I watched them for so long, it was hard to tell, to be honest. I know that with some species, the female will, you know, the eggs will be fertilized and she will drop them. And the female will then pick them up in her mouth to start with. And then she'll almost kind of, try to entice the male. So she will spit them out at the male to try and get him to pick them up. And if he doesn't, she will pick them up again and she will spit them out at him. And she kind of, again, the female fish kind of leads the male to kind of do the right thing at the right time. So, and I did see them kind of jostling with each other. And I think these two were, again, they were quite new. So I think they were both a little bit clumsy. So they were definitely picking stuff off of the floor. And I think, you know, depending on the size of the fish, it's going to depend on the size of the egg a little bit. And I never saw the exact egg, but they were definitely kind of doing this pattern of passing things around. And again, that went on for quite some time. And you can see when the male's taking the eggs in because his jaw becomes, you know, becomes quite extended. Like the jowls under his gills become quite obvious. It's a bit like, you know, if you can imagine someone eating a whole pork pie in one go, or something along those lines, swallowing a giant cupcake or something. His cheeks, as it were, and his throat are quite pronounced. And at that point, he will just go. The female will lose interest in him, and he will go off and hide in a little corner somewhere and look after the eggs in his mouth.
So it probably looks a lot like a mouth-brooding cichlid does. Like I used to keep Mbuna cichlids, and they'd get that sort of same look where their mouth would swell up and the buccal cavity would be very, very visible. You could see from across the room almost that they were...
Oh yeah, definitely, in my experience, it seems that as the fish get older and larger, because the clutch of eggs gets bigger, so you can kind of see the first time a smaller fish, had some kind of first generation from that spawning which grew up and then spawned, but they were much smaller. They were starting to spawn probably about an inch and a half, but you could see that there weren't as many eggs. But of course, it's kind of relative to the size of the fish. But I've looked at fish in tanks before, not seen them spawning, but seen the males kind of hiding away, not coming out to feed, and you see this distended, this kind of distended jaw on them, so you know immediately that they're brooding some eggs in there.
And how long is the incubation period?
For me, it was round about 2 weeks. Because this is all done in a fish room, all the tanks are pretty much the same temperature. Talking to other breeders, I think if the temperature is just a few degrees lower, the incubation can just take a few days extra. But my fish room tends to run at round about 25 centigrade most of the time. I mean, we've got our first kind of summer heat wave now. So I've just come home from work and opened the door because it had gone up to 30. But this is the other thing with certainly a lot of the mouth brooding bettas, they actually prefer the water in the lower 20s to mid 20s. When it starts getting past that point, certainly for a length of time, you know, they can become a little bit more stressed. So they prefer, a lot of people will keep them at what's classed as room temperature without any heaters, and kind of allow more seasonal fluctuations. You know, when the weather naturally warms up in the summer, they'll kind of do more of the spawning then. So it is. In most cases, they're comfortable to be kept in a house without a heater at all.
That's quite a contrast from the Betta splendens, which usually have to be kept quite a bit warmer, about 80 Fahrenheit. So what is that? That's somewhere close to 30, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. That's about right. Yeah. But no, a lot of the mouth brooding ones like it on the slightly cooler side.
Yeah, and is that's because they come from more flowing water where it's like...
Yeah, I think generally there is a little bit more water flow. I mean, none that I know of come from, you know, what you would class as fast-flowing water, but they tend to have more of a current in the water. I mean, they're all unabanded, so they will breathe from the air. But, I mean, again, because it mines in the fish room, all the tanks have air-powered box filters, so I don't have like a pump blowing a current across the tank. But so the filtration is done that way, and it depends on how many filters are in there. If I put more filters at one end, it can cause a little bit more of a current. But no, they like it a little bit cooler. If they do get warm for a little bit, they're fine. But on the whole, you know, room temperature is generally pretty good for them. I did read somewhere that if you're comfortable, the fish are comfortable.
Okay. So that makes sense then. Now, once the incubation period's over, and how did it come out when you saw the male begin to release the fry? How did that all work out?
Well, I've always found the fry really quite early in the morning. Whether that's just coincidence or not, I'm not sure. But it seems to be. I've had this with guppies as well, where they tend to release the batches of fry kind of in the early hours of the morning, or either kind of just as the night, you know, through the night, and then you find them first thing in the morning. But this seemed to follow a similar pattern. So you can see immediately when the males release the fry, because he's still fairly quiet, but you know that bulge has gone out of his mouth. And what's quite, for me at least, been quite useful is that although he's kind of starved himself for a fortnight, none of the males of the species I've kept have ever tried to eat the fry straight away. You'd think they'd be that hungry, they'd go for anything. So the fry, and the fry are very, very small. I mean, I would say, you know, probably half the size of an average guppy fry. They are quite a small thing. So you've got to kind of look for them. But if the male's kind of, you know, swollen jaw has gone down, you know immediately that there's fry in that tank. And I always used to put in like a little sunken spawning mop or some Java moss or something like that, so that the fry could go off and kind of hide in there. Or you would see him behind one of the little box filters or something along those lines. And they're perfectly formed and they've no yolk sac, so you can start to feed them straight away.
Okay, and what did you give them?
I have an infusoria culture, which I used to start with because they were just so tiny. And I fed my fry on that for at least a fortnight, and probably kind of used that for, in the third week, I would just start to add either bitter brine shrimp if I'd hatched some out, or one of the things that I use quite a lot is the blister pack frozen cyclops. So, and I've talked to breeders since of you know, that some friends of mine, kind of a bit like me, they kind of go through periods of breeding all sorts of fish, and we've talked about this fairly recently, and we've kind of come to the conclusion that if you feed them a slightly smaller particle food over a longer period, especially with something like a really good infusoria culture, because it's live in the water, they'll eat as much as they want when they want. so you don't have problems with brine shrimp dying or frozen foods all sinking to the bottom and messing the water up. But they'll regulate their own kind of eating better if you can put a small alive particle in the tank. So I never rushed into getting them onto big foods very quickly. I just kept them on the smaller stuff, and they seem to do very well. I never really had big losses with them.
So just since they're naturally adapted to eating small amounts kind of constantly, you're kind of going with that model, it seems to be successful.
Yeah. I mean, the infusoria culture that I got from a breeder, so it wasn't one of these things of like drying out turnip and putting it on a jar on the windowsill and that kind of thing. It was a really high quality infusoria culture that I got, and that was basically sucked up with a turkey base. So I'd fill a turkey base up full with the stuff first thing in the morning, put that in the tank, and it's just going in. It's not in, like, again, with brine shrimp, you don't have that the pH and the osmotic pressure problems. So it will stay alive in the water column for hours and hours and hours, or days even, until it gets eaten. So I would just put a big turkey baster full in there first thing in the morning, and you can see the little fry come out immediately and be pecking at invisible particles. They're quite robust, and they're quite lively. So you kind of see them poke out from the Java moss and peck away kind of in midair. And then they'll shoot back in again, and of course they'll kind of dart in and out for quite some time. And I would do the same again in the evening when I came home from work. I would get another turkey baster full out of the infusoria culture and pump that into the tank. And it was as simple as that, certainly for the first couple of weeks. And then I'd probably vary it. I'd put some infusoria in the morning, and then just a small bit of either brine shrimp or cyclops in at night, and kind of move them on to the next food stage over the period of about a week, building the feeds of that up more and dropping the infusoria off.
Okay, well, that sounds like it's been a successful method.
So during this time period, are they still in the same tank as the male?
Well, the first time they were all in one tank, and they started to get to be a bit bigger, and then the adults decided to pair off again, and I thought, oh no, what am I going to do here? So I thought, well, what I'll do, I'll move the adults into another tank at the side temporarily, and I'll catch all the fry out of this bigger tank and put them in a small rearing tank. And it just took hours and hours and hours, because although you've seen these things start to grow, you're never sure how many there was. And I think the first batch I had about 25, but they were only like 2 millimeters long. So going around with this tiny fine shrimp net, trying to catch all these out and count them and put them in another tank, I had to strip all the stuff out of the tank. And then I put the breeding adults back in. Eventually I got them all, and we put them in a big jug, and then we put them in a little tiny rearing tank. The second time I decided to do this seriously, I actually had them in a small tank, let them pair off. When they'd spawned, I used to take the male that was holding the eggs and put him in a small tank of his own. He would then stay in there for 2 weeks. The other two fish could go about their own business. If the female to spawn again, sometimes a female can spawn, you know, week out, every kind of 7 to 10 days. So she had another male to pester while he was holding the eggs. So I would let him stay in the tank, release the fry, and then I'd move him out again into a third tank on his own, another tiny little tank, and then I could let him stay in there for a good 2 or 3 weeks and feed him up on some like grindle worm or white worm or something like that, get him kind of bulked up, get him back into good condition, and then put him back in the tank. So it became a kind of three-tank process. But even if I had a male that was recovering and had another male that was brooding, I could put him in the tank with the fry that were already there, let him release the second batch of fry, and then move him out again to be conditioned. So all the fry eventually built up in one tank. And although there were different sizes, I never had any problems with them out-competing each other.
That's interesting. There's a lot of, with a lot of species of fish, if you get any kind of size differential, they will start cannibalizing their younger relatives. But it sounds like with this fish, you don't have to worry about that.
No, I'd never had any problems with that. Never had any problems with older fish being more aggressive. And, you know, by the time the new fish were out, I would just be putting infusoria in, which was too small for the bigger fry, and the particles they were eating were too big for the smaller fry. So it kind of balanced itself out.
Yeah,
I mean, you could kind of do all this. This is why, if you really wanted to, you could have a nice little kind of, you know, 10 or even a 20-gallon tank and just do the whole thing in one tank if you're just wanting to rear up, you know, a few fry. But I was wanting to rear up, you know, quite a number of fry. And I was being in the fish club, I was going to sell them on at auctions and things like that. And so I was trying to maximise the output for a short time. But again, because of the nature of the fish and the way that they eat, you know, you could comfortably build up a nice little colony in a smallish tank.
Yeah,
pretty good location.
Right, and there's something appealing about being able to use either method depending on what your goals are.
Yeah, exactly. And it was for me because I decided I would have half of this shelf dedicated to this one particular fish, and that was fine, you know. But if you if you don't have that kind of room or that amount of tank space to do stuff, you can comfortably do it in a, you know, a tank even in your living room.
Nice. And I do. It's fun just to be able to look in a tank and see that a spawn has occurred, and then just watch everything happen in an informal way. But it's also nice to be able to, when you feel like it and you have the space and equipment, to just go a little bit more intensively.
Yeah. I mean, because of the nature of the fish, I mean, the peaceful fish, and you find that, you know, the mating fish will have more colour intensity and the little fry are kind of doing their own thing. And it would make a nice, interesting house display to have those things going. And again, you don't need to do too much specialised stuff with the rearing. So you could, you know, you could quite comfortably do it in a little tank in the spare room or the living room at home, and the whole family could watch this kind of growing on and developing and see the fish growing up. The one thing to bear in mind with these fry, a bit like a Pistogramma fry, they are painfully slow to develop. They are really, really slow. I mean, it took at least 12 months for my first generation fry to be of a size to be like about an inch and a quarter, inch and a half, and then they would start to, then they were starting to spawn themselves. So unlike a lot of the live bearers, which develop pretty quick, and some of the cichlids, which will develop quite quick to start with, like the albino crebensis and the angels and stuff that I've done, the fry grow pretty quick. These do grow quite slowly. So it's just one of those things to bear in mind. You will have very tiny fish for quite a long time. But then they suddenly kind of develop pattern and everything and start to go on. So when you see them, even when they're very small, I mean, my eyes are fantastic, but you can see they have the same habit. They'll curl the tail behind. They'll have that kind of typical better pose as they're stalking the infusoria and the tiny cultures. You can see their eyes. You can kind of see them once they're a couple of millimetres long. They do look like very, very tiny fish, and they have all the habits of an adult better.
That's going to be fun to see.
Oh, yeah, they're a fun fish, definitely.
Well, how much experience do you think an aquarist should have before they start keeping mouth breeding bettas?
I think it depends. I mean, over there, you guys tend to have mostly harder water. We're lucky here. I mean, where we're based, we're right at the cross point. So just up from us, the water gets pretty hard. It's kind of, we're quite near the shoreline and things like that. So, but we're lucky that we have this soft water, and we're right at the bottom. We're kind of at the border of North Lancashire and the southern end of the Lake District. So we get a lot of rainfall, which is great for capturing water. But we're lucky, it's quite soft. So if you've got access to, you know, either soft water, or if you've got an RO unit doing something like that, if you can, you know, get the water right in the first place, I'm not saying it can't be done, because I'm talking to other breeders that are breeding these things in soft water. So whether you can acclimate them into harder water, I'm not sure. My tanks balance out at about 6.8. So the fish do okay at that. So if you're in a position to be able to manage your water quite well, maybe you've done some guppies or something like that before, so you're used to seeing fry. I would say breed some of the standard easy fish. Get used to. You will need to get used to culturing some of your own live foods. So, you know, listen to some of the podcasts that you guys have done about microworms and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And get into culturing some food. But I think if someone's been a serious aquarist for a year or two and they want to try something that's a little bit different and they've bred a few of the kind of, you know, the starter fish or the easy fish, cultured a few foods, it should be a really interesting project to pick out.
Yeah, I must say that it's ever since we first talked about you breeding them and you sent us those pictures and we put them on the show, I've been intrigued and I'd like to try that sometime myself.
Yeah, they're definitely going to be a rewarding project. And there's so many different species, and you will see as they develop and as the kind of courtship starts, those colours and patterns change. You know, I mean, some of the species can be pretty expensive. This again is one of the kind of bonuses of being involved in a club. You know, whether it's a national club or a local club, I'm very lucky that I know people that breed all sorts of different fish, and so I can either get them pretty cheap or free, which is even better. But again, if you've got a good local shop there that has that kind of thing in, you know, you can pick something up pretty nice and have a nice, attractive fish there to do something new with.
Yeah, I've looked at some pictures of these mass breeding bays, and some of them are really striking. Like you say, they're maybe not as necessarily as bright as some of the Thetis splendens cultivated varieties, but they have a lot of interesting, striking patterns, and they're beautiful fish.
Oh yeah, quite a range. I mean, the only one I've got at the minute is these better rubra, and it tends to be that the males have the more intense colour. The females can often have a nice colour as well, but the males have the more intense colour, slightly longer, more pointed fins. But, you know, a nice wild type, certainly, I mean, and rubra is a fairly common one, and it's one that can get a good price here, but again, not over difficult to feed. But they are, when you see those in good condition, they are a superb fish.
We'll have to put those pictures up on the show page that you sent us before. We have them up on the episode when you were spawning them, but we need to put them up here so that people can take a look at them as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some pretty good pictures. I think I got them kind of in the clasp in the embrace as well, which was pretty good.
Right, and I remember that, so we'll have to put that up so that everybody can see that.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any other info you want to give us, like anecdotes or caveats or anything?
I think the main thing, like I said quite early on, is if you're going to get these fish, I like to... buy from or swap or do whatever with a breeder. So I would say, you know, if there's not necessarily a better club, if there's just a general fish club near you, join it, get to know people, get to talk about people. If you can get fish that's been bred in water that's similar to your own, you're going to have a good head start, and you're going to have a resource there to go back to. You can email, or you can see people at the club and say, you know, what's this, what's that, how do I do this? So I would say, number one, if you can join a club, do that. And if you can get fish from a breeder, you know, even better. I mean, I'm sure everybody will have their own tack on how they'll do it, and it might be very different from what I did. This is just the way it kind of worked for me, and it started almost by accident. But the lid, I think the lid is the most important thing. The number of people that's breeding all the different kind of species that they've lost fish because of the jumping out. So I would say definitely have whatever setup you've got, however you do it, have the best lid that you can possibly have on the top of that tank. There's nothing worse. The original ones that I got, two jumped out, and I was left with one male simplex, which was a nice fish, but no good for spawning. And he was just swimming around quite lonely on his own. So And I think like, because I think they used to be in the group, so these are better bought as a small group, by half a dozen, you know. And even if you're buying younger ones, like I've done with my Aruba now, buy a small group and bring them up. Unlike the Splendens type, you want to buy one and have it either in a little bowl of its own or have it in a peaceful part of a community tank. But I think they definitely do better in groups. But there's nothing more soul destroying than kind of having some lovely fish and finding one dried on the side of the carpet somewhere. It's just such a sorry end for the fish, and it's such a disappointment to the keeper. So I think those are the main things. And get used to, you know, some people are put off fish breeding by thinking, oh, we've got to have all these different kinds of things and spend half as time messing about with food cultures. But you know, if you just kind of do a few bits like that and get to know people who are doing it, it's get used to breeding these food cultures. It's not something that's difficult. It adds an extra dimension onto the hobby. You know, and I get as much joy out of, you know, getting a good microworm culture going, or, you know, splitting up my white worm culture and passing it on to friends as I do as breeding the fish. You know, that's just as interesting as the fish sometimes. So don't be put off by these things.
Right, yeah.
Very good advice.
I've noticed that's part of the fun too. When I see my Daphnia breeding like crazy, and I think, wow, this is fun. This is
yeah,
fun.
And I noticed you've put some videos of your Daphnia buckets up, so I'm going to go and have a look at that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a fun project setting that up.
I know we had a convention at our fish club about 2 years ago, and a guy came and he did a whole hour's talk on culture in different kinds of fish, which was really, really interesting. He had the cultures there to kind of buy as starters as well. One of the things which doesn't take much looking after and is really good to get for bettors is fruit flies. We keep various amphibians and reptiles and stuff. So from time to time, we buy the little, you know, the established fruit fly culture pots, and you can just tap the lid of these pots on, drop the fruit flies on the surface, and the bettors will go absolutely crazy for them. They love the little things twitching on the top. So if you want to get them out from hiding and up and feeding, then try some fruit flies on the top. That's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I've noticed when I've cultured the flightless fruit flies, everything I kept was excited about it. The cardinal tetras that usually like to stay in the lower half of the water column would dart up to the top and take it. They wouldn't take flake food or pellet food from the surface, but they would take fruit flies.
Yeah, yeah. I've not found many fish yet that won't eat them. Yeah. So that's another a cool aspect. And again, I mean, I was listening to an interview with Heiko Blair recently, and he was talking about, you know, his big thing is about the kind of natural biotope thing. And I think the more that you can kind of recreate a fairly naturalistic environment and food source, the more those natural behaviours will come out, and the more kind of interest that will give you in the fish that you're going to keep. So, I mean, I don't take it to the extreme and source plants from one location, but if you can kind of naturalise things a bit, and this is what I'm doing in my fish room now, I'm actually starting to add a little bit of different substrate into things and do a little bit more decorative tanks, because it can get to be where you've just got like 20 glass boxes with some nice fish in and a filter, and it can look a little bit clinical. So I'm actually starting to change that a little bit and get the fish room looking, you know, like a nice aquarium, and I'm actually starting to notice that the fish definitely respond, not always in spawning, but, you know, you can see fish that are happier. Fish tend to be more active as well. So looking at the environment and the foods, I think is definitely a good winner.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's some good advice as well. So as far as resources, for someone who's interested in learning even more about spawning mouth brooding bettas or obtaining stock or things like that, where would you send them? Is there a website or two that you would send them to?
Yeah. I mean, I can email you the links for some of these, but I mean, obviously this is going to have a slight UK bias, but we have the British Unabanted Society, which cover quite a big range. They have, you know, they will have localized members, and they are, you know, they're a nationally recognized group. They have a good website. So I'll send you a link for that. There's a guy kind of just up the road from us as you get into Scotland, a guy called Colin, and he runs an online, he's kind of a breeder and an importer as well, and he specializes in anabantids, and he's called The Fish Hut. In Scotland, so I can send you a link to him. He's got a blog on his site. He's a really good anabantid specialist. He has some really superb stock, and he gets some of the more unusual stuff in as well. When we went up to see him, I think it was the last winter, he had some fantastic sparkling gouramis that he bred. A small little fish, but a wonderful little fish. So he's a good expert, his fish are good, and if you're in the UK, you can kind of do mail order through there. And just a general all-round site is the International Better Congress site. They've got articles, they've got a species list, so you can look up, you know, colour images of fish, look up the scientific names and get a kind of a description of their recommended setups and kind of what to expect from that fish, whether they're a bubble nester, whether they're a mouth brooder, kind of, and all that kind of stuff. So they're the kind of three main sites that I know of that I would recommend.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and we'd love that if you'd send us the link there, and we can also put that on the show page as well, so that people can have an easy, quick reference.
Yeah. I mean, they're the kind of three places I use. And if you get in touch with a specialist society, whether you join up or not, you know, if you've got a question, you probably find something on their webpage, or there'll be a forum that you can look at, or a contact that you can get in touch and ask questions with. I think it's if you do develop a particular, I've never developed a specific fish angle, but if you do, I think it's great to get involved with some kind of, you know, specialist organisation, or get to know a local specialist breeder that can just steer you in the right direction and help you along the way.
Right, you can bring those years of experience to bear on your own, along with your own, and
oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky. The club that I'm in covers a huge part of the northwest of England, and you know, there's people there that, like me, that's always had an interest and got into breeding in the last few years. There's a guy that I know that's been breeding fish and showing fish for kind of nearly 50 years now, and if there's a fish that's out there, he's bred it, he's reared it, he knows it inside out. So, you know, there's people you can talk to there. So I think with anything, to take the kind of the fear out of it, or to maximise the pleasure, if you can share that with someone else who's interested, then that's a real bonus.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. That's also part of the fun, the interaction with other aquarists and sharing your successes and your frustrations and so on, and getting some good advice.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing worse than feeling like you're banging your head against a brick wall, and you can drop an email or text somebody or whatever. There's so many ways to get in touch with people these days, you know. It's great to share it out. And, I mean, I'm very lucky as well. I mean, like you guys, as a family, we're all very kind of, you know, interested and involved in all these things. So it's nice to be doing this thing. It's pretty much my thing is the fish, but, you know, it's something that as a family we can all kind of enjoy. So that's pretty cool too.
It is. It brings another dimension of enjoyment to it all.
Oh, yeah. If my partner Claire comes up in the fish room, she usually goes, oh, what's these babies you've got in here? And I'll say, oh, I don't know, I never saw them. So I think her eyes must be a bit sharper than mine. Certainly, when I was breeding the little blue-eyed rice fish, those fry are super tiny. So I would say to her, come and have a look through these mops and see if you can see the fry in here. And if she could see them, even if I couldn't, I would start to feed them so I knew they were there. So if you know someone that's got good eyesight, if you know someone, even if the guy next door has brilliant eyesight but he's not into fish, get him to come round and have a look, see what he can see.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll start getting into fish, become interested.
Yeah, exactly. What a way to pass the message on, yeah.
A fishy convert.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to work behind the scenes sometimes.
Yeah. Well, we had a neighbor child over the other day playing with our daughter, and he pointed out something in our 55 downstairs, and he said, what are those? And I wasn't home, but everybody was intrigued, and they asked me when I got home, and they were bristlenose placo eggs that were kind of hanging out of the cave, I guess.
Oh, right.
Usual. And so, you know, it was fun for all the kids and fun for me, because I've never actually seen the eggs, because they've always been hidden, but this time they're kind of sticking out of the cave, so we got a chance to get up some photos of those.
Ah, brilliant stuff. Yeah, it's amazing. I think sometimes, because I kind of go in the fish room and I have periods where I'm just managing it and periods where I'm really concentrating it. And again, one of the, I think the best thing that you can do is, you know, is watch your fish. Spend as much time as you can watching your fish. I know a friend of mine that lives on his own these days, and he's got a fish room with about 30 odd tanks in there, and he eats his meals in there. So he can sit and he'll sit in front of the tank eating his supper or having his breakfast or something, and he's watching to see what's going on in his fish tanks. He knows what's going on in there. So, but yeah, sometimes I just kind of get on with things and I'm not looking the same, and I had some friends round from our reptile club a couple of weeks ago, and I've got these four-spot Merry Widows, a nice little live bearer that a friend gave me. And someone said, oh, they're really tiny ones, those, because they are a small fish. And I'm like, oh, yeah, there is a smaller one. Oh, crikey, they've had some fry already. I didn't think they were big enough. So I have a few little fry, and now I know they're there, I know to look for them. So it's pretty cool that way around. If you can share these things between other people, it's a good thing to do.
It is indeed, yeah. And speaking of sharing, thank you for sharing your experience and your expertise, and both today and throughout the history of Aquarimax, you've been a contributor and a friend of Aquarimax for a long time. So we'd like to thank you both for today and for everything that you've done to help bring the show forward and keep it going.
Oh, well, thanks for giving us a chance. It's really good to be kind of, you know, it's like, in a way, you two do the shows and everything, but it's almost like being part, there's like a little online community of fish keepers going there right across the world, which is fantastic. You know, you two kind of provided that great forum for us all to get together, and it was really cool last year to send Paul over in Durham there the cherry shrimp. We kind of organized it. It went from me and Canfus to you guys over there, then it came back to Paul, who got in touch with me. It was pretty cool to think that the kind of that's something that can be done these days, and to be able to share that stuff. So that was great, and you two have, you know, you've put on a great show, and it's been brilliant to be part of it, and I've really enjoyed talking to you today. It's been great fun.
Well, we've enjoyed it very much as well, and we'll see if we can pull it off again sometime.
Yeah.
Now we know the technology works, we can do it again. Good to speak to you. Speak to you again sometime.
Oh yes, you too. Thank you.
Bye, Nick.
Okay, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.